Good afternoon, Your Honors. Nathaniel Deakins, representing Mr. Hopper, registration number 38752. I'd like to focus on the special offender claim, and unless Your Honors have questions about the other claims, I'll focus on just that issue. And I would like to reserve at least some time for rebuttal. The thrust of this argument involves legislative intent. And as this court is well aware, there's many cases that have interpreted the special offender statute. People v. Whitaker interpreted a different provision of the special offender statute as not requiring a mens rea. However, I think for several reasons, we call it collectively the deadly weapon provision is different in kind, and there's a different policy reason behind this provision, which required the trial court to instruct the jury, as defense counsel requested, that Mr. Hopper had to know that the firearm in this case was available for use. And the trial court's error in failing to include that mens rea allowed the prosecutor to exploit the ambiguity in the language so as to allow for the jury to convict Mr. Hopper based on a strict liability, more or less, theory.
What's the difference between the Whitaker case and this, in as much as they're both contained within the same subsection of the statute?
There are a few reasons why Mr. Hopper's case is distinguishable, or this provision is distinguishable from the one interpreted in Whitaker. The one that jumps out first is that this provision was enacted in 1992 by a different General Assembly. The provision interpreted in Whitaker was enacted in 1981. It was part of the original special offender statute.
What's the difference in the structural language that would cause a different result? The fact that we have different years doesn't seem to suggest much if the structure or language isn't different as well.
Well, I think there are language differences and policy reasons as well, but just to point out first that the legislative intent as interpreted in Whitaker doesn't necessarily control the interpretation of this provision because it was a different General Assembly and it was subsequent too.
And yet in both General Assemblies they did not put a culpable mental state in either one of those subsections.
They did not expressly include it, no, Your Honor.
Right.
I think looking at the deadly weapon provision, and there are four different ways in which a person can be held liable as a special offender under the deadly weapon provision. One is that they used a deadly weapon in furtherance of. One is that they possessed it in furtherance of. One is that they displayed it in furtherance of. And then you have this, what I see as somewhat of an ambiguous option, which is available for use, in that the first three necessarily or inherently include some level of scienter. In that you know, if you use a deadly weapon, you're aware of it. If you possess it, you're aware of it, especially under the definition given in this case. And if you display it, you're aware of it. Now, this available for use, under the circumstances of Mr. Hopper's case, without the knowingly element included, was capable of it was ambiguous in that the prosecutor was allowed to argue that Mr. Hopper, even if he didn't know it was there, was still a special offender. Now, I think that the legislature did not intend for that outcome. Just by looking at the first three, and I think one of the canons of construction is to give harmonious effect to the statute, that available for use, the legislature intended a certain level of scienter or awareness. And I think that also gets into one of the policy reasons behind the statute, which is to protect police officers.
Hasn't this argument been made, like in Whitaker, that, gee, the language suggests that there's a culpable mental state implied there as well, and the Supreme Court has rejected that, said no, there's no culpable mental state here?
Well, certainly with respect to the importation provision, Your Honor.
Right.
And we're here arguing that this is substantively different. And I think that if you
don't have to knowingly import it, someone else can import it, and you can still be tagged for a special offender. Same thing, made available for use. You're saying, no, you have to knowingly make it available for use. Why? What's the difference between them?
I think if you look at the policy justifications for these provisions, or the let's take, for example, the Whitaker provision, which is importing, I think the evil or the danger that the legislature was seeking to prevent was the introduction of drugs into Colorado. Now, whether or not the person is aware that the drugs are being transported from Utah, let's say, to Colorado, the drugs are nevertheless now in Colorado, which endangers Colorado citizens. But if you look at the deadly weapon provision, a police officer, you know, and I don't take police officer safety lightly, but if you look at the, a police officer is not endangered by a person who doesn't know that a firearm is available.
Are police officers the only one that we're worried about being endangered under the special offender provision? Could other people be endangered by the availability of a weapon?
I think that the combination of drugs and guns creates a danger to other people, yes. Yes, Your Honor, I do. However, I don't think that the legislature intended to protect people, but that policy is not furthered by interpreting the statute to not require awareness of the presence of the weapon. I think another way that this case is distinguishable is that the other provisions, I'm just going to get a drink of water here. With these other provisions, the circumstances or facts that the prosecutor must prove to establish special offender are directly related to the underlying felony. So for an example, in Whitaker, the importation of the drugs relates to the drugs. And in Ramirez, which is a court of appeals case affirmed by the Supreme Court without an opinion, involved over a certain amount. And that, again, is directly related to the underlying drug felony. However, in this case, the deadly weapon provision involves a discrete item, another illegal item, and so therefore it's distinguishable in that way, in that when a person brings drugs on a bus from California to Colorado, they bear the risk that they will be crossing state lines, as opposed to And likewise, with a certain amount, and I think the Court of Appeals in Ramirez said the same thing, that you take the risk when you possess a large quantity of drugs that might be over 1,000 pounds. However, this is different because it's a separate item, and when Mr. Hopper, you know, possessing a bag of cocaine and a bag of methamphetamine, but yet was completely unaware to a discrete item that was in the back seat. So I think that this provision is distinguishable in that way as well, but mostly for the policy reasons underlying these different provisions.
Why isn't that argument better addressed to the legislature? I mean, if they want to amend the statute and put a mens rea element in it, they can do so.
I certainly agree, Your Honor, and I think that is always the case. However, this court is charged with the duty to interpret the statute and the legislative intent behind this 1992 enactment.
That presumes, our embarking on interpretation presumes it's ambiguous. What's ambiguous about it?
Well, that there's a common law presumption that when the legislature enacts a criminal provision that it requires a mens rea.
Fine. There's a presumption that when they create a crime, this is not a crime.
I agree that this has been interpreted as a sentence enhancer, and for the purposes of this argument, I think that's fine. But my position is that it doesn't necessarily do away with the canons of statutory construction, if you will, or the common law presumption that a mens rea is required, especially when you see a jump in the sentence, the max sentence, as we do here, from 6 to 48 years.
Deacons, can I switch your focus for a moment? I'd like to talk to you about the Gantt issue.
Sure.
One of the concerns is whether you get the benefit of the Gantt decision, since you didn't raise that specific issue in the trial court. Would you address that, please?
Well, I think that the substance of, or the focus of the Fourth Amendment suppression motion was certainly the stop. I'm not sure that defense counsel waived the argument, especially in light of the name McCarty, I believe, which says that GAN applies retroactively.
Don't you have to raise it to the trial court? I don't think there's any dispute that it applies to Mr. Hopper's case, but don't you have to raise it in the trial court, or at least raise a search incident to arrest to be able to argue a search incident to arrest issue on appeal?
I have to, a look at the written motion, I think, would it clarify whether this was properly preserved? And I, off the top of my head, I can't recall whether or not the search incident to arrest was challenged in the motion. And I think that if it was included in that, it would be fairly presented before.
But defense counsel specifically said, as I recall it, that his rationale for suppression was that there was no reasonable suspicion to stop the vehicle, and that if there was reasonable suspicion, the search of the vehicle would follow as a search incident to arrest. So it sounds like defense counsel actually conceded the search if there was indeed reasonable suspicion.
I do recall the defense counsel saying that, and I don't think that waives Mr. Hopper's right to appeal, given the change in, or I would say the change in the law. I don't concede that. I suppose I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal if there are no other questions.
Good afternoon, Alice Hosley, registration number 32195, on behalf of the people. I'd first like to respond to opposing counsel's arguments on the mens rea requirement in the jury instruction. And first, I'd like to set out the issue that was presented and before this court is, did the trial court err in instructing the jury on the special verdict form with the absence of a mens rea? The statute, 18 407 1, does not require a mens rea requirement. Thus, the special verdict form is identical to the language of the statute. There's a presumption that jury instructions that track the language of the statute are presumptively valid. To the extent that opposing counsel wants to challenge the constitutionality of the statute based on the fact that there's no mens rea requirement within the statute from which the special verdict form stems from, the constitutionality of the statute has not been preserved or raised below. It was preserved in the sense that the opposing counsel or the defense counsel below asked for the mens rea to be included in the special verdict form, but not on constitutional grounds. His point was, I think his words were, I know the case law is against me on this, but in these circumstances, I think it's required. I think our case law is pretty clear that that is not sufficient to raise a constitutionality of the statute in order to give everyone notice that that's actually the issue that's being presented. Having said all that, I think it's informative how the case law in this state have treated sentence enhancers. They are not a substantive offense. They are strictly to enhance a punishment. The underlying offense is the only way the sentence enhancer is triggered is based on a finding of guilt of the underlying offense. Thus, there's the underlying offense stands regardless of any showing of the special enhancer aggravating circumstances.
Are you suggesting that the special enhancer, special offender interrogatory was erroneous?
No.
Well, I thought when you said the conviction stands apart from the sentence enhancer, I thought you might have been suggesting that.
No.
Okay.
I don't think there's anything wrong with the sentence enhancer. I think it matches the language of the statute. My point is only that the underlying offense stands alone. All the elements have been met. The jury made the findings. The special enhancer statute is only triggered by such a finding, but it itself does not require a mens rea element. And so there's nothing wrong with the statute or the jury instruction that also do not explicitly lay out a scienter mens rea. I apologize if I gave the impression that I think the Colorado requires the fact finder to enter the special finding. Notice is required. It's required to make the finding beyond a reasonable doubt. I don't think there are any due process concerns about increasing the level of penalty or punishment based on the aggravated circumstance of having a gun readily accessible after you've been found to possess with the intent to distribute controlled substances.
Well, under your analysis, for example, if the defendant got into a vehicle not his own, driving with permission, and underneath the seat were two handguns, in this situation, he'd still be guilty of the sentence enhancer, would he not?
Because he would only be convicted of the sentence enhancer if he was convicted of the possession. Possession does have a...
But the possession is of the drugs, not the guns.
That's correct.
Okay, so my question is, if he gets in a vehicle that's not his own, he knows nothing about it, and there are two guns underneath the seat, and he's got the drugs with him, and he's charged with possession of the gun of the drugs. Conviction of possession of the drugs doesn't necessarily mean that he absolutely positively knew the guns were there.
That's correct.
And under your interpretation, he'd still be guilty of the sentence enhancer, wouldn't he?
That's correct.
So but it is essentially a strict liability offense.
Well, but it's not an offense.
I know, but a strict liability statute, let's put it that way.
Provision, yes. Right. It is a circumstance in that the existence of the circumstance is what ratchets up the punishment because the danger and the intent to regulate the distribution of drugs includes with it the enhanced danger of also having weapons within the nexus, the proximity of those drugs.
How is the policy furthered if the defendant, as in Judge Casebolt's example, was ignorant of the weapon?
Well,
I take it a step further, because I suppose you could infer maybe he kicked the gun with his foot under the seat. Suppose it's in the glove compartment. He borrows a car, he's got his own drugs in his pocket, and he's pulled over for a traffic offense. He would theoretically, under your interpretation, be vulnerable to a substantially enhanced sentence for a weapon of which he did not know its existence, so therefore he could not use it and create a danger to the public or police officers.
That's correct. That's how the statute reads, and the General Assembly has not required the mens rea. If they wanted to require the mens rea, the intent, they certainly could have. I think the intent of the statute is to regulate the conduct, the illegal conduct of the distribution of drugs, and the policy is that the combination of guns and drugs increases the danger to both society, police officers, anybody in the way, even drug dealers to each other. So I think the
to agree that the policy falls of its own weight if the defendant is ignorant neither knows nor has any reason to know that the weapon is accessible.
I think if, under your hypothetical, which I don't think is the case here, I don't think that harm is possible in this case, which I'll get to in just a second. But to respond to your hypothetical, I think having weapons that are accessible, which again, you may not know the second that you get into a car whether there are guns, but you may not know when you get pulled over that there are guns that are accessible to you. But if they are deemed accessible, that has increased the risk. Again, your hypothetical gets into a what does accessible mean? If it's in the glove compartment, if it's you know, in the trunk, I think that that would require maybe a more definition of accessibility. In this case, the facts that we have are that there was a SKS rifle partially covered in the backseat of the car that Mr. Hopper was driving. There's no evidence presented at trial other than opening statement and closing statement by defense counsel. The defendant did not testify. The only evidence that we have is in opening and closing statement that the defendant didn't know it was there. The trial judge rejected this idea that you can't know that there's a gun in the back of your car, in the back seat of your car that you're driving, that's partially uncovered, that, you know, could justify a plain view doctrine search. The idea that he didn't know it was there is not supported by the record and the facts in the case. So I don't think this this evil that would possibly be presented as contrary to furthering the policy is present based on the facts in our case where we don't.
Let's go back to the hypothetical that had been posed by Judge Casepol and Judge Webb.
Sure.
You know, as I understand the policy is we don't need the combination of drugs and guns. And so drugs and guns present a particular level of danger. Why can't the legislature say, basically, is because of we don't like this combination of drugs and guns, we lay it on you, defendant, to know the circumstances and to eliminate the possibility that guns could be around when you're possessing your drugs? Why isn't that okay? As well as, why can't the legislature say, whether you know it or not, it's not important to us, and we're not going to require the state to prove the knowledge in any event? Why isn't that a policy that could be rational in this area?
I don't think that is precluded by the language of the statute. I think there are a lot of varying policy reasons. I think back to the fact that they could have included a mens rea and they didn't. I think may go to further such a policy as they don't care if you possess guns. If you possess drugs.
The reason I ask you this, counsel, is because it's a little difficult to say, well, under the circumstances of this case, you know, it's clear he knew the guns were there. When he was acquitted, wasn't he of possession of dangerous weapons?
He was acquitted, correct, of the, that's correct.
Yeah, so doesn't that raise a little question as to whether or not the jury might have said, gee, there might not have been a culpable mental state there element of that offense? So I don't think we can necessarily just assume that, well, because of the evidence, he knew the guns were there.
I don't think we can assume, but I think based on the evidence that we do have before us on the record, and the trial court's rejection of the, you know, of the new evidence, how it doesn't, I know this isn't the issue we're talking about, but I think all of this bolsters this argument about how the trial court itself couldn't, with this new evidence, couldn't get to the place where he couldn't understand.
But the problem with that position is that, you know, you're saying the trial court gets to make a decision, and here the decision should be made by a jury. So that's a little bit different. I want to switch gears on you before
Sure.
your time runs out.
Okay.
Why can't he raise the Gantt argument at this point? You know, the law at the time that he was stopped, the law at the time of his trial, would have precluded a Gantt type of challenge. Why can't he take a, why would we consider it to be waived when there was no basis in law at the time for him to assert it?
My response would be Mr. Gantt asserted it, and it actually has been raised a number of times before Gantt, I think, which is why the posture of the Supreme Court at the time that it reviewed Gantt thought it was necessary, just because, and as the opinion in Gantt told us, that it was not a reversal or departure of the previous law. It had just been misinterpreted for a number of years. So I don't think that...
Let me bring you back to that question. It had been misinterpreted for a number of years.
Yes.
Yeah, obviously, it must have been misinterpreted by our own state Supreme Court for a number of years. What was a defense counsel to do in light of the misinterpretation by our Supreme Court?
I think you still need to raise the search. If you have a problem and you think that there is an issue, it has to be raised. Otherwise, nobody below articulated the reasons for the search. We are absent a record on appeal where we could determine whether or not under the circumstances of Gantt, it would have been allowed. Specifically, the if there is reasonable suspicion that there's evidence of the crime for which the arrest is being administered, there's evidence in the record that the arrest warrant for Mr. Bowler, who was a passenger in the car that precipitated the events in this case, had an arrest warrant out for third-degree assault, false imprisonment, as well as felony menacing. Felony menacing, by definition, requires the existence of a deadly weapon. During the surveillance earlier in the day, they had seen somebody that they later identified as Mr. Bowler carrying a rifle. They had information that Mr. Bowler was never without his sawed-off shotgun and his Italian witness pistols. Only the Italian witness pistols were found on his person when he was arrested. I see my time is up. If I have no further questions, if I've answered your question sufficiently, I thank you for your time and ask this court to affirm Mr. Hopper's conviction. Thank you.
I just want to go over the evidence supporting Mr. Hopper's theory. This sounds like the court is well aware of the evidence, but just to show why that this was harmful and why this particular option of available for use is troublesome under the trial court's interpretation without the mens rea of knowingly. Of course, it's not that hypothetical where a person goes to a party and there's drugs involved and the person uses drugs and there's a gun under the couch. Because there, if you listen to the prosecution's theory, Mr. Hopper is Pablo Escobar and he's in on this with these other two gentlemen. But if you listen to Mr. Hopper's theory, he is innocent and maybe he had some drugs, but he wasn't aware of this large-scale operation or whatever was going on. There's many different avenues the jury could have gone here. And the lead officer observed Mr. Bowler, the passenger, with the black SKS rifle, or what appeared to be Mr. Bowler with the black SKS rifle that morning. Mr. Bowler and the gentleman in the back seat, Mr. Putney, got into one vehicle, and Mr. Hopper got into another. Mr. Putney's vehicle had mechanical problems. They were driving along together in sort of a caravan and pulled off into an area known as the Adobes. And that's, Mr. Hopper has argued that that's where the guns and the drugs, but for this argument, I'm not really arguing about the drugs, the guns were transferred into Mr. Hopper's vehicle. Now, when the car was searched, the gun was partially covered by a blanket, and I believe it's exhibit number 3, your honors can look at exhibit number 3, it shows the state of the rifle when the photo was taken. Now, there's some problems with the testimony. I think even the lead investigator, Officer Severson, contradicted himself about in what state the rifle was discovered. From it was there in plain view to it was covered And we moved things around when we took the photo. So I think that the jury was entitled to accept some of that, disregard some of that, but that there is evidence to support Mr. Hopper's theory that the gun was, he didn't know the gun was there. So, and I think that it's important to focus on the fact that this is an instructional issue, and I, as this court stated, it was up for the jury to decide. And just to get back to the Gantt issue really quick, I think that this issue is preserved because the trial court included in its order, the topic was discussed at the suppression hearing. The trial court included in its order the search incident to arrest finding, and therefore this court can review it.
It will be preserved when no objection is raised to it. The fact that the trial court makes a ruling to which no one alerts the trial court that there's a problem. You think just because the trial court references something that's a preserved issue?
Well, that there's an order for this court to review. In other words, that the trial court felt it necessary to include that in its order. Thank you. We ask that this court reverse Mr. Hopper's convictions.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. As soon as counsel